Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labor MPs.
Kia ora tālo whālama. My name's Carmel Sepuloni. I'm the Labor MP for the Kelston electorate and also Labor's social development spokesperson. And today I'm very lucky to be joined by the wonderful Katrina McLennan, who's here to talk to us about a range of issues around social development, housing, and just also just the impact on some of the government's changes, some of the government's policies on women in the social development space. So, Katrina, thank you so much for joining me today. Maybe we'll just start with Katrina, if you could introduce yourself and just talk a little bit about your background and some of the things that you're involved with at the moment.
Kia ora, tālo whālama, Carmel. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a lawyer and a journalist. I practice law at Otahuhu and Manukau for 14 years. I also, earlier than that, worked as a political reporter at Parliament for 6 years. And in 1999, I helped set up a community law centre in Otahuhu because I'd been working in a small law firm there for a couple of years doing mainly family law and domestic violence work, and I sort of saw quite quickly it was really hopeless if all I was doing was applying for a protection order on behalf of a domestic violence victim when there were so many issues going on in her life. So I helped set up Ngā Tere Kaitiaki Ki Waikato Community Law Centre so that I could work with a community worker and try and take a bit of a broader approach to the issues. And we opened our doors on the 1st of February 1999, and I'd said to the trustees, oh, you realise all I know is family law and domestic violence work, and that's the only sort of law I'll be able to do. But of course, as soon as we opened the doors, all these people came pouring in with loan sharks and employment and criminal and traffic and immigration. So I had to learn a whole lot of other areas of law really quickly, and that's where I got very involved in doing probably the main things were benefit law, but also credit and loan sharks, because both those areas of law lawyers don't really know a lot about and don't do, because it's just impossible to make any money doing that sort of thing. Mm. And then later on, I was involved in helping set up a microfinance scheme to give affordable loans to people, and that's Ngā Tangata Microfinance Trust, because I just saw what a terrible impact it has on families when they can't get loans and they're driven into the arms of loan sharks and they get really horrendous debts with high interest rates and all sort of fees and penalties. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've done some great work. I guess it's such a varied career when you think of the fact that you were a political reporter for 6 years, and then here you are driving some, you know, major progressive change, I guess, in the work that you're doing. One of the campaigns that you've been involved with recently, Katrina, and are actively involved in at the moment, is the Stop the Sanctions campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that campaign?
Sure. That's a campaign that's been started by Auckland Action Against Poverty, and they've just done a fantastic job with the campaign. I'm so impressed by how they work and all the different skill sets and how they can bring people together. And so we had the launch a couple of weeks ago, but actually they'd achieved quite a bit before the campaign Absolutely. Was even launched. And as you know, and you were involved in Labor agreeing to support this Stop the Sanctions and the Greens and the Māori Party. So,
and New Zealand First.
And New Zealand First, yeah, which is really good work. So I think probably, as usual, getting any change on this is all going to come down to Peter Dunn.
Yes.
So, yeah. But what that campaign is about is that if women can't in law identify the father of their children when they're getting a benefit, they're actually docked money every week, and it starts off being $22 a week if it's one child, and then if they still can't identify the father, the amount moves to $28 a week, and then there's deductions made for each child. So as we all know, benefits are deliberately set at a level that's too low for families actually to live on, because supposedly that will you know, everyone enjoys being on a benefit and they
to
suddenly
try and disincentivize
get a job,
that lifestyle.
Even so, there's no jobs. So, you know, that's just a massive amount to be taking away from some of the poorest families in our country. And I know that when this campaign's launched, I know that you had a conversation with a taxi driver, and people who might not have thought about this before might not understand, well, how do you not actually know who the father of your child is? Well, obviously, one circumstance might be if it's a one-night stand, but the more common issue is that there's serious domestic violence and threats of violence, and women get threatened and sometimes physically beaten because the man says, you're not to tell Work and Income or Inland Revenue that I'm the father, because they don't want to pay child support. And the government in recent years has been doing a big campaign to try and reduce domestic violence, but these sanctions are actually putting women and children in danger. And what women have to do at the moment, if they can't identify the father, to try and not have the sanction, is they need to go and see a lawyer and get a letter from the lawyer saying that the lawyer's view is the woman cannot identify in law the father. But one problem is there's hardly any lawyers that do those letters. I used to do them in the community law centre, but a community law centre is probably the only place you'd get them done. So it's difficult and expensive. And it's really intimidating and humiliating for the woman, because the woman that came to see me to get these letters, normally I'd never even met them before in their lives, and I had to ask them all these really detailed and intimate questions. When did you meet the father? When did you have sex? And I had to ask them all this because before I could sign a letter, I had to be satisfied that in law there was no way of identifying the father. And, you know, we don't put men through such a humiliating process ever. So what Auckland Action Against Poverty is asking for is that in the rewrite of the Social Security Act, which is happening at the moment, that these sanctions be repealed. So I really do hope that that will happen.
Can I just give you a case, Katrina? I've just written to the minister about this particular case that's come through, and you might be able to give some advice on this before we get a reply back from the minister. I'm going to call this woman Anna. That's not her real name. But basically, 9 years ago, she had a child as a result of rape. And she told Work and Income New Zealand that she didn't know the father's surname. She only knew his first name. And then they sanctioned her, regardless of the fact that she'd told them that it was a consequence of rape.
Well, that's against the law for a start, as I'm sure you know.
So 9 years later, she, you know, got advice that she should go to a lawyer. So she's gone to a lawyer, and the lawyer has written that letter, the letter you're talking about that you've been asked to write in the past, and confirmed that it was rape. And so now the sanction has been lifted, but Work and Income New Zealand have not done anything to actually backdate the payments 9 years where she had it deducted because of the fact that they didn't accept her reason for not naming the father. So what do you think her rights are in this situation?
I haven't actually dealt with that. I've only dealt with writing the letters. But, yeah, is the lawyer going to pursue the backdating?
We're going to pursue the backdating with the minister. So she's asked about it, and by the sounds of it, has been told no. It won't be backdated, but we're actually, I've written to the minister and, and explained the situation. I guess legally it would be interesting to see whether or not she had a case.
Well, I guess what it would do would be she would have to say, first of all, that that Work and Income had made a decision she wasn't satisfied, and go to a benefits review committee, and then go to the Social Security Appeal Authority. I mean, maybe I could help out a bit with that. Yeah, that's just absolutely shocking. And I mean, that amount of money for 9 years would obviously make a massive difference to her family. It would be a huge amount. I might just mention while we're talking about this, the Social Security Appeal Authority actually told Work and Income in 2010 that it was actually applying the law wrongly and requiring people to get these lawyers' letters, and it there was a specific decision which said that common sense dictates if a woman is unable to name the father of her child, she cannot establish who is in law the other parent. Pretty common sense. And then the authority said, we do not know if any reason why a beneficiary would be more likely to reveal this information to a lawyer than to a ministry investigator. And that case actually said, we recommend the chief executive review that policy. But of course, that was 6 years ago and absolutely nothing has been done.
Nothing's been done, I just, going back to what you said about who will be, so this particular issue, Stop the Sanctions, is up as an amendment now with the Social Security Act rewrite going through, one of many amendments. And we were just discussing this before we came on air. It's just unfortunate that it is going to come down to Peter Dunn. But as I was saying to you, Katrina, he refuses to meet with me about any of the amendments, including this particular amendment. So disappointing. Yeah.
That's really disappointing that he won't even meet with you. You know, you'd think that he might at least start off with an open mind and at least have a meeting with you. So I think what it's really important for people to do who are concerned about this issue is email or Facebook, or is Peter Dunn on Twitter? I'm not sure. But email or Facebook him, because it always sounds really boring, you know, emailing and Facebooking politicians, but actually it's the general election next year. They want to be popular. They want to be re-elected. So if enough people contacted him and said, hey, first of all, meet with Carmel, but secondly, support repealing these sanctions, it would really make him think.
Yeah, I would hope so. And I have seen David Seymour's response to this issue, saying that that, you know, it's important that the absent father is held to account. And I think he just misses the point, really, doesn't he? That, yes, they should be held to account, but it shouldn't be by punishing the mother who has made the decision to look after her child or children and those children. And that's exactly what it's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's plain that the absent father is not being held to account. All you're doing is punishing the mum and the children and ensuring that the children grow up even more in grinding poverty. And I think people say, oh, well, you know, it would be expensive if we didn't get this money back. But number one, we're not getting the money back. But number two, if we just compare our attitudes on a couple of other issues, so in the 2015 budget, the government said it would write off up to $1.7 billion in child support debt penalties, and then between 2008 and 2014, Inland Revenue wrote off $5 billion in tax debt, and every single year up to $6 billion is lost through tax evasion. So we seem to have a sort of fairly easy attitude to these billions in some cases, but we go after beneficiaries and especially beneficiary mums for $22 a week. It's a real absolute double standard.
Yeah, it is, and this is not the only policy that is particularly harsh on women or sole parents, is it, Katrina? Yeah. I mean, I sometimes just want to shout out, why do you hate sole mums so much? You know, like, why do people hate sole parents so much? Solo mums, really. So, I mean, there are other examples of policies that do really unnecessarily punitive towards women and children. And so some of those, Katrina, that you can think of?
Well, we've got a very complicated law at the moment for when a sole mum is entitled to get what we used to call the DPB and what's now called sole parent support. And in law, they have to not be in a relationship in the nature of marriage. And already probably most people would think that sounds a little bit complicated, and they'd be completely right. And the legal test for it is very complicated, because obviously relationships are not cut and dried. And, you know, when does a relationship actually start, and when does it turn into a relationship in the nature of marriage? And this has been, the issue over this has been going on for more than 20 years. And in the 1990s, there was a very famous case about this ruka, involving a woman who was seriously beaten and assaulted and subjected to violence by her so-called partner for 17 years, and he came and went as he pleased, provided no financial and emotional support. And the Court of Appeal in that case said that was not a relationship in the nature of marriage, but work and income in the 20 years since then has still continued to apply the law wrongly. So we've had mums actually sent to jail for benefit fraud when they shouldn't be, and that's obviously really terrible for the children because they're already in a single parent household, and if you send them to jail you're taking both the parents away, and actually at that point you're pretty much wrecking most of those kids' lives. It's, you know, they've just got so little hope. But one of the worst things is when those mums come out of jail, work and income immediately starts deducting money from them because they say they've got to repay the entire debt. These are women who have already been seen a judge, been given a jail sentence. But are we going to leave it at that? No, they'll be pursued for the rest of their lives. And I wrote a report earlier this year for Child Poverty Action Group about this. It was looking at the story of one beneficiary called Catherine, who's had a completely tragic life. She was, her father was violent in and out of jail. Her stepfather sexually abused her. Her 18-month-old boy was killed by one of her partners. And she was later prosecuted and convicted of benefit fraud and sent to jail. And her children were thrown out on the street. One child was sexually abused. Another child was physically assaulted. And since Catherine came out of jail 15 years ago, Work and Income has been trying to get her to repay $117,000.
Do they do this with any other area? So if you end up in jail for, I don't know, tax, fraud, hefty fines through the justice system, I don't know.
No, it's completely a double standard here that we're far more punitive to these women. So when someone, I used to be a Judy lawyer for 11 years, so when someone appears in court and they're convicted and sentenced on another criminal charge and the judge is considering fines or reparation, the judge will not impose fines or reparation, which can't be repaid, in the maximum time of 5 years, and generally if it can't be repaid, it would generally be a shorter time. So there is no other circumstance in our criminal law system where you are going to be chased after for the rest of your lives. It's only these mums convicted of benefit fraud.
And do you know what proportion of those convicted of benefit fraud are women as opposed to men?
No, I don't know that off the top of my head. Obviously, the relationship and the nature of marriage one, that is almost all woman.
Yeah.
And another unfair aspect of that is that if they are in fact guilty of benefit fraud, which, you know, I'm saying many of them aren't, actually the male partner has also benefited from the fraud, but they are never pursued. And when we were in the High Court in 2013 with Catherine's story, the judge actually asked about that because her ex-partner, who, you know, they were not actually in a relationship then, but if you took the Crown view that they were, the judge said, well, why didn't you go after the man who'd been in a stable job for something like 19 years then? And the Crown was just not interested in pursuing the man at all.
Yeah. And when you think about tax evasion, you can, and maybe it's just, you know, an assumption, but I think it's likely that it's probably more likely to be committed by men, evasion than...
Absolutely, tax evasion, not paying child support and child support penalties, and having tax debts written off, that's absolutely overwhelmingly men, like it would be over 80%. And I can perhaps just mention one case as an example. Any listeners that are perhaps of the older age group might remember in the 1990s, two lawyers in Lower Hutt, Renshaw and Edwards, did a multi-million dollar fraud. And they were convicted and sent to jail. Well, one of them last year was convicted again on multiple tax charges involving $347,000. Now, this is a man who's already been involved in a multi-million dollar fraud. And what he got was a short period of home detention and sentenced to repay only $13,000.
Oh, my God.
And compared to Catherine, it's just absolutely, what can you say, other than
outrageous.
A total double, double standard.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's shocking. Oh, okay. Okay, well, let's move on from that subject because I want us to talk about another really important issue, Katrina. I know you've been doing some work on that, and that's housing.
Sure.
So we're, as an electorate MP, I've just posted another story up of a family who are in a two-bedroom house, two families, 10 kids, four adults, kids sick often, including with strep throat, and just unable to get access to state housing and treated incredibly badly by work and Income New Zealand and Housing New Zealand in the process. But recently, Katrina, also, you know, even just last week, dealing with two separate families, both sole mums, one with a four-year-old in emergency accommodation, coming to us so scared that she was going to have to get out of her emergency housing and nowhere else to go. Another one with three children, one on the way, single mum again, and homeless. Mm-hmm. And so what's going on, Katrina? What are you seeing? What are you hearing with respect to the housing issues?
Well, it seems pretty clear we've got a massive crisis, and what's going on from the government is virtually nothing. I mean, am I being too unkind to say actually nothing and not even say virtually nothing? There's the government is not prepared to acknowledge that there's a problem, and it's doing tiny little things really to try and make it look as though it's doing something rather than to actually do something. So I think the cross-party homelessness inquiry from Labor and the Greens and the Māori Party is just a fantastic initiative.
Yeah, so unfortunate that the Select Committee voted it down, refused to do it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that had to be instruction from the powers higher than them. So, you know, I guess you made a submission, Katrina?
Yeah, I did a submission on behalf of E2. I did the written submission, and then some E2 members presented oral submissions in Wellington to the inquiry talking about their own experiences. So it was sort of quite a good combination, I think. So in the submission I did, I looked at international initiatives to address homelessness. I looked at several different countries, and I looked at Indigenous people's experiences of and suggestions about homelessness. And then I did some recommendations about how we could address homelessness in New Zealand. I might just mention at the start something interesting in Australia, which I haven't heard mentioned as to something that might be picked up on in New Zealand, but in 2007, a report to the UN by the Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing concluded that Australia had failed to implement the human right to adequate housing and was in the midst of a serious national housing crisis. The Special Rapporteur said that Australia was a rich and prosperous country, and low-income households were spending more than 30% of their incomes on rent. So I think it's interesting, and I think if we were, for example, to have a visit from the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, what would that person find here? And
God,
I think we would be likely also
be
to
be in trouble.
We would be likely to be sanctioned, as Australia would be. So anyway, as a result of that, the Australian government started trying to do something, and Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in December 2008 and the Housing Minister released a white paper on a national approach to housing, and that set a goal of halving overall homelessness by 2020 and offering supported accommodation to all rough sleepers. There was a House of Representatives Standing Committee on Family, Community, Housing and Youth, and quite a few other initiatives. So I think that probably came from that UN Rapporteur's report. In Canada, in 2013, it was estimated that the annual cost of homelessness to the economy was $7.5 billion Canadian dollars. And there's a initiative there, the Homeless Hub, and they've done a number of reports. Vancouver has done some public and private partnerships. In the UK, there's been initiatives going on about homelessness since at least 2000. They had a green paper on housing. They set out a vision for housing in the 21st century. So I was just really making the point that these other countries have actually been looking at this for a lot longer than we have, and, you know, trying to have policies, and that's both Labour and the Conservatives in the UK, the same in the United States. There's been various initiatives there. And then I looked at Indigenous people's experiences of homelessness, because, of course, Indigenous peoples in Aotearoa, Australia, Canada have far higher rates of homelessness than their percentage of the overall population. So in Australia, Indigenous Australians have four times the rate of homelessness of the general Australian population. In Canada, there's been a very big report there, Aboriginal Homelessness in Canada Literature Review, that looked at First Nations populations represented in over 50 distinct nations, and their experiences are called Aboriginal Homelessness in Canada an epidemic, and said that about 90% of those living on the street in some cities were First Nation peoples. So yeah, it's certainly a massive, massive problem.
Yeah, and, you know, I get to travel around the country a little bit, and I've seen some, you know, some decisions that have been made by the government that just have me throw my hands up in the air. Just sharing one with you now, Katrina. In New Plymouth, there was a Housing New Zealand area called Marfell. Everyone knows Marfell down there. And the 8 years ago, the decision was made to develop that area to build new housing. So a lot of the housing was taken out. Some of it is boarded up. All those families were, well, most of those families were shifted on.
Sounds familiar from Auckland, doesn't it?
Yeah. 8 years later, nothing has been done. And when I put an Official Information Act request in, what I got back was the two reasons that nothing has been done is, one, that they haven't been able to find an appropriate social housing partner, and two, they say that there is no longer the demand for housing. And so that's really difficult to reconcile with the what I'm hearing from the emergency shelter down there, that has experienced a 35% increase over the last year in the number of people needing emergency shelter. So it is, you know, shocking to put that into the context of this national housing crisis, to visit that area, see houses boarded up, empty space, land available for building, and nothing is going on. There are other examples of that that you know of as well?
I just think, what's so hard about the government saying it should be responsible for housing people? You know, I mean, we could do that in the 1930s in New Zealand. What terrible things have happened to our country and our attitudes to our citizens, that we think it's okay for people to be living in cars with kids. It's shocking. And, I mean, I think the other really bad thing is that houses are for people to live in. Houses are not investments. Houses are homes. And so we've really got to get away from that. In some other countries, what they've done is they've passed homelessness acts. What I suggested in the submission I did was, I thought we should have a Homes for All Act. I just think that's a much better way of looking at it than homelessness. And it should be a Homes for All Act that specifically places a responsibility on the government and perhaps local authorities to house everyone. So in Auckland, the number of ghost houses we've got is almost equal to the number of families in serious housing needs. So it's in a way, it's not even that we don't have the houses, but now we think houses are an investment. So why can't those families living in cars, why can't they now move into these houses that have been empty for months, or in some cases years?
And I mean, I guess, you know, putting it into kind of an international context like you have with regards to the research that's come out of other countries, what struck me recently, particularly watching the Clinton-Trump debate, them discussing all of these issues that they face as a nation over there, is actually, with a population of 4.2 million people or whatever we are at the moment, our issues are not insurmountable, really. We know where the poverty is. We know what the issues are, including housing. And so all it takes is actually a comprehensive plan to address them, isn't it?
Absolutely, and we've got the money. You know, if we just got the billions that we're losing from tax evasion, we've got the money there. So yeah, it's just, what's lacking is political will.
That's right, that's absolutely right. Hey, thank you so much, Katrina. There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about, including John Key saying that it's impossible to measure child poverty rates and a whole lot of other ridiculous things that the national government have been saying. saying recently, but we don't have time. But I do appreciate the fact that you've come on to talk about some really important issues today. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.